starting up again. Downstairs, muffled by the towel covering his cage, the parrot said, "Wash the bones. Bring the body. Leave the heart behind."
Hattie Morahan continues to read The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrecht at 2:30 tomorrow afternoon. The abridger was Sally Marmion and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
There's a 60-minute drama at 3 o'clock based on the Ramayana, a love story and one of the great Hindu epics. Before that, R.A. Scotty's account of the events that followed the extraordinary day in August 1911 when the Mona Lisa went missing from the Louvre in Paris, when even Picasso was implicated, but later proven innocent in court.
It was another scorching day. The sun so blazing that even the carriage horses were wearing straw hats. Maximilien Alphonse Poupardin was slumped on his stool in the doorway of the Salon Carré. He was weighed down by the weather and by an unseasonable lunch. Cassoulet, more suitable for a winter Sunday. In everything except name, old Poupardin was a simple man who felt elevated in a uniform. First, in an army uniform, and now in the costume of a Louvre guard. He was ignorant of the 4,000 years of art and history that surrounded him. He knew nothing of the medieval knights who had staved off Anglo-Norman invaders, or the lusty young kings François I and Louis XIV, who had turned the Louvre into a palace. Poupardin knew only one emperor, the cocky little Corsican and epic pillager of art, Napoleon Bonaparte. On an average day, several hundred visitors would traipse through the galleries, students, artists, foreign travellers, and Frenchmen from the provinces. But visitors were few on this Sunday afternoon. An occasional tourist roused the old guard from his nap. Three macaroni were whispering together. Poupardin glanced at them with disdain. They were dressed in their Sunday best, black suits and straw boaters, but no suit could disguise what they were. Young, working-class men who had come to Paris from the mountain towns of northern Italy, looking for work, and more often than not, finding trouble. There was one other visitor. The young German had returned with flowers. Men had been coming to court her for years, bearing flowers, notes and poems that Poupardin scooped up and tossed out at the end of the day. She gave nothing in return. Just the same half-smile. A promise, a tease, a warning. No man could be sure. Poupardin saw the visitors without seeing them, as he saw the paintings without seeing them. He was anticipating the next day, Monday, his day of rest, when the museum was closed for cleaning. By 4 o'clock, when the bell clanged, signalling the museum's closing, the macaroni and the young Goethe had disappeared. Poupardin picked up the oleander and folded his stool, the doors banging shut behind him. On the wall, she appeared dark, her colours muddy, her attitude aloof. Seen in the light, she has the colours of the Tuscan countryside. It doesn't matter that she has spent nearly her whole life in France, or that the French call her La Joconde and claim her as a national treasure. Italy is her homeland. On Sunday evening, 20th of August, 1911, Leonardo da Vinci's best-known painting, conservatively estimated at $5 million, was hanging in her usual place in the Salon Carré. on Tuesday morning, when the Louvre reopened to the public, she was gone. Sauntering early through the galleries on Tuesday was amateur artist Louis Bayrou. The Louvre encouraged amateurs, allowing them to copy the masters and store their easels and paint boxes overnight in the numerous nooks and cupboards recessed in the wall panelling. There was one stipulation. No canvas could be the same size as the original. It was a modest and mostly ineffectual effort to prevent forgery, which was endemic throughout Europe. Bayrou intended to use his brush to vent his displeasure at a new museum policy of placing the most valuable paintings in three-dimensional protective frames. The first to suffer the indignity was Mona Lisa. An Ingres had been slashed a few years before. Bayrou's idea was to paint a scene of a man shaving in the new glass that protected Mona Lisa, or a young girl using the glass as a mirror to do her hair. He turned into the Salon Carré, a gracious square gallery with a rare collection. Her place on the wall was empty. All that remained were four iron hooks and a rectangular shape several shades deeper than the surrounding area.
Brigadier Popadin, where is Mona Lisa?
Being photographed, I suppose. A project to photograph the entire collection was underway, and paintings were regularly taken off to be copied. Depositing his easel and paints, Bayrou left the museum. When he returned around 11 o'clock, the wall was still bare. Brigadier Popadin, find out when she will return. The guard sauntered off to the photographer's studio. Mona Lisa, La Joconde, was not there. Leonardo da Vinci's most famous work was missing on his watch. Lost or stolen? He tore through the halls and burst into the director's office.
La Joconde, c'est parti!
As the museum guard set off on a search through the picture galleries, the chief of the Paris police was informed. Prefect of the Seine, Louis Lépine, arrived with an army of gendarmes. No one was allowed to enter or exit. Even the borders of France were sealed by his order. Unless Mona Lisa were found within the next few hours, her disappearance would become a national scandal. As a curious crowd gathered outside, inside the police made their first discovery. Two frames were pushed into a corner of a service stairway, a few yards from the Salon Carré. One was a three-dimensional glass box. The other, an antique carved wood, and bore the label Leonardo da Vinci, 1452 to 1519, École Florentine, La Joconde, Portrait de Mona Lisa. Both frames were intact, the wood undamaged, the glass unbroken. By all appearances, Mona Lisa had stepped out of her frames as effortlessly as a woman stepped out of her petticoats. Within hours after the discovery of her empty frames, the story broke. The New York Times had opened a Paris office 3 years before, and its correspondent arrived at the scene at about 5:30 p.m.
La Joconde is gone. That is all I can say, the curator told the Times man. Why the theft was committed is a mystery to me, as I consider the picture valueless in the hands of a private individual.
The story travelled round the world as swiftly as telegraph and cable could carry it.
The entire world sat back aghast.
The New York Times. The British Times.
What is perhaps the most famous picture in the Louvre has been selected for abstraction.
1911 was a year of grand escapades. In the boatyards of Belfast, a magnificent new ocean liner was under construction. Its builders boasted that it would be unsinkable. In Antarctica, Captain Robert Falcon Scott was trudging across the frozen plateau to the South Pole. And in Paris, the plan had been brewing to pinch the most famous painting in the world. Of these three grand escapades, the first seemed assured of success, the second likely, and the third not only improbable, but impossible. But the Mona Lisa was gone. Prefect Lépine called in the one person he believed could illuminate her vanishing act. Alphonse Bertillon. Bertillon, with his magnifying glass, dusting powder, and a trail of assistants carrying bulky cameras, had introduced a revolutionary form of criminal examination called forensic detection. Around the same time, a Scottish surgeon named Henry Faulds was trying to convince Scotland Yard that the whorls on the tips of the fingers were unique to each person. Although Bertillon only grudgingly accepted fingerprinting as a vital detection aid, he became master at lifting prints. Halfway up the glass, on the left side of the box frame, Bertillon found a smudge. Dusting the frame with finely ground graphite, he lifted a perfect thumbprint. The Mona Lisa thief had left his calling card. The hunt was on. In the Salon Carré, Prefect Lépine ordered Mona Lisa stolen again. The first time, gendarmes committed the crime. They struggled for more than 5 minutes to remove the painting from the double frames. The second time, experienced Louvre workers posed as the thieves and performed the same feat in moments. Suspicion pointed to an inside job. Lépine requested a complete list of everyone who had access to the museum between Sunday evening and Tuesday morning. Each custodian, curator, cleaner, workman and photographer would be fingerprinted and interrogated. Under intense questioning, Popardin did recall a group of young swarthy men whom he described as mangeurs de macaroni.
Did one of them carry a package? Did they leave together?
Popardin had not paid close enough attention on Sunday to answer the questions. He also recalled the young man who came to call often, as if paying court. The fatal attraction theory appealed to the French heart. If Mona Lisa were gone, at least she had been stolen for love. August the 24th. The investigation entered its second day. A department store employee, who was walking on the Quai du Louvre about 7:30 a.m., had a vivid memory of a man with an odd gait and a bulky package under his arm, speeding towards the Pont du Carrousel. A second witness recalled a man, also carrying a bulky package, sweating profusely and rushing to catch the 7:40 express train for Bordeaux at the Gare d'Orsay. Connecting trains could carry the thief out of the country as far as Madrid or Lisbon. A Louvre plumber named Sauve mentioned that a knob had been missing from the stairway door opening into the Cour du Sphinx, the same stairs where the frames were discovered. On that Monday morning, Sauve had found a worker waiting at the foot of the stairs for someone to open the door. Sauve obliged, using his key and a pair of pliers to unlock it, and advised the other man to leave the door ajar so that no one else would be stuck. Police detectives raked through the garden behind the museum and retrieved a small, shiny object. It was a brass doorknob. But why would the thief toss it into the garden, where it would be easy to find? Reporters canvassed the opinions of art dealers and museum directors in France, England, and the United States. All gave the same answer. The painting was too famous to be sold on the art market for any price. But what if the thief did not intend to sell the painting? There was a suspicion on both left and right of the political parties in Paris that the balance of power in Europe had upset Mona Lisa from her secure spot in the Louvre. Germany was expanding its navy, challenging Britannia's rule of the waves and threatening French control of Morocco. What if the government had faked the theft to divert attention from the war threat? What if it were a prank to dramatize the lax security at the Louvre? Or were disgruntled workers settling scores? Worse, what if it were curators covering up a botched effort at conservation? Everyone had a theory, but no one had a clue.
The Lost Mona Lisa by R.A. Scotti was read by Nicholas Grace, abridged by Penny Lester, and produced by Duncan Minchell. and tomorrow the theft of the painting goes undetected for more than 24 hours. But then, uproar. Now, before the drama hour, here's Justin Edwards with news of Radio 4 Extra's DIY topical comedy show.
Prime the main stories of the week. Insert a load of sketches written by you. Cut some celebrities' egos down to size. Then file away any unwanted material before showing it off for all to see.
News Jack, made for 4 Extra. Thursday evening at 10:30 and again on Sunday evening at 11.
And there you have it, a beautifully crafted topical comedy show. Which is a shame, really. I was hoping for a coffee table.
The BBC search for new stand-up talent continues.
Lady at the bookshop, where is your pantomime section?
Coming to you once again from Manchester.
And she said, it's behind you.
10 more acts take to the stage to see who will win the fourth heat.
Slugs come from the same family as snails, but bad life choices have left them homeless.
The 2013 BBC Radio New Comedy Award continues here on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
So with your fancy radios, you can have a listen.
In Friday night's Comedy Club at 10:30.
Well, come on, there's a sense of humour. That's comedy gold!
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Jim Lee with today's 60-minute drama, which is one of the world's most popular love stories, but in a modern setting. In the 4 o'clock show, Fred McCauley's back with the general knowledge quiz, Keep It in the Family. And this evening, there's an Agatha Christie thriller about a family who live in a large, crooked house. When the millionaire head of the household is murdered, which of any of his family could possibly be to blame? Crooked House is at 8 o'clock tonight. Distinctive modern version by Amber Lone of an ancient Indian epic and one of the world's most popular love stories.
Who'll be the first one of us to rule?
Don't talk like that. Father's still alive.
I don't want to be queen.
It's only a matter of time before you walk away to a new life.
Father won't let me.
It's not him who keeps you here. It's all the puny men who can't lift Shiva's bow.
Just as well. I'm not ready to move on.
Well, maybe you'll get your wish and live out your days in the palace.
I don't want to.
What's that?
Can you see anything?
Look, down there. Strangers. Who are they?
Shh.
Dog.
He's handsome. Who is he?
Look away.
I can't.
Hide, Sita. If anyone catches us spying.
Have a peek. Oh, he's got massive arms. And he's smiling at me. Do you see him?
They're carrying guns. Are they soldiers?
His skin's so rich and brown. He's like a terracotta statue.
You're making it obvious.
Isn't he the most stunning man you've ever seen? I have to marry him. Help me do it. You must, or I'll bury myself alive.
Don't curse yourself. It's obscene.
I want the gods to know what's in my heart.
Come away from the balcony. For all you know, those two are just yops.
Not with a face as divine as his.
Sometimes you sound like a common...
At least I can admit it when I fancy someone. See this scarf?
What are you doing?
Tempting fate.
A scarf, pink, suits you. It came from above us.
Ah, there, the upper balcony window, do you see?
Stop the truck.
We can't let a couple of girls hold us up.
Stop the truck, Luxman.
Okay.
Stop the truck! Do you see her?
Who?
The girl in the pink silk sari. She's staring at me.
Well, don't stare back. What if she's a servant? One of the royal family. I'm not here to insult the king.
I've never seen eyes like hers. Like a gazelle. And that red mouth upturned like a tulip.
Brother, please, talk sense. A random girl on a balcony.
This one's special. Unique. Bewitching.
All right, she's beautiful. So is the other one. The one next to her. We should move on.
So why are you rooted to the spot?
Come on, let's go. People are staring at us.
I have to find out her name.
No.
But...
I'll do it, I promise. Now, come on, let's go. Let's go!
I wait in my room all afternoon. I lie on the sheets and my head fills with thoughts of him. My sister's angry with me. I embarrassed her by staring. But I couldn't stop. And when he walked on, my heart hurt. I imagine how the two of us might meet again. What I'll say, what I'll do. It doesn't matter who comes for me now. If I can't be Rama's, I won't be anybody's.
We arrive at the palace and are brought to King Janak. His advisors whisper about us as we approach the throne. Turns out we're local heroes here. We brought peace to the borders.